Genesis chapter 10 is where we are this evening, so we're going to get through Genesis 10 and into 11. Genesis 10 is a genealogy, and that would be the genealogy of those, the survivors of the flood. And although most people tend to see that and skip over the genealogies of the Bible because they don't think that they're very exciting, there is a great deal of information that you can learn from the genealogies, and if you pay attention to them and read them, you'll find out that you learn quite a bit from them. Now, we're not going to go into into a great deal of in-depth study as far as these genealogies go. You could, if you so desired, some of the names that you're going to read in this genealogy you're probably going to recognize, and you could follow the trail of some of the sons of some of these folks and find out where they lead to throughout the Bible. We're not going to take the time to do that because, frankly, we could spend weeks and weeks in doing that. But meanwhile, we're going to hit some of the highlights and give you an idea of the outcomes of some of the sons of Noah. One of the interesting things about the genealogy here is there's, of course, Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives got on the ark. And when the three sons are listed in the genealogy, you think, well, there's no particular order, because usually when the sons are mentioned, it's Shem, Ham, and Japheth. They're listed in a different order in the genealogy, and it's Japheth, Ham, and then Shem. And the reason the genealogy list them in that particular order is that in your Bible, the people that the Bible deals with are mentioned in their relationship to the nation Israel. Israel, of course, being the people that God chose to deal with, them being the descendants of Abraham, and God's chosen people. And so generally people, nations and peoples are mentioned and dealt with in the Bible as they relate to the nation of Israel. And it's not as though there weren't other people in the world. We know that there were other people in the world, weren't there, Mike? Not once are the Chinese people ever mentioned in the Bible, but yet we know that there were Chinese people in the Bible. There were Native American people in the world, but yet they're not mentioned. So it's only because they didn't have any bearing on the nation Israel. Well, so here we have the three sons of Noah, and in increasing order, that's how they are mentioned as they affect the nation of Israel. So first come, not Shem, but rather Japheth. Japheth and his descendants have the least amount of impact upon the nation of Israel. And from Japheth comes the what would be termed, I suppose, the Gentile nations, Indo-Europeans. When you think about European nations and those type of people, you would think of the descendants of Japheth. In Genesis chapter 10, verse 1, now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood, the sons of Japheth. Now, these are some of the names that are mentioned that come up later in the Bible. And, for instance, Gomer and Magog. One of the sons over here is Tubal and Meshach. Now, these are become nations that Ezekiel mentions prophetically as nations that God is going to bring against the nation Israel. God is going to use these nations prophetically, and then he is going to destroy these nations. So it's going to be in a bad way. So they're Gentile, you know, they're mentioned as Gentile nations. They're going to remain Gentile nations, and God is going to use them for his purpose in a prophetic manner in the last times. So meanwhile, the sons of Japheth, you have Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan, Tubal, Meshach and Tyrus. Then as you don't get all the sons of all the sons, but rather ones as they relate to the nation Israel. So you have the sons of Gomer and Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. Togarmah, of course, is one that is going that's mentioned prophetically in the Bible. The sons of Jabin, Ishhoth, and Tarshish. Kittim and Dodanim, and by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families, in their nations. So what you're looking at is eventually each of these nations has its own language, has their own territory, has their own country, and so on and so forth. Even though they come from one of the sons of Noah, and that son being Japheth. And as Gentile nations, they have the least amount of bearing upon the nation of Israel and the least amount of importance in their history, simply because they have the least amount of contact with that nation. Even today, these are the nations that do not have nearly as much bearing upon the descendants of Abraham as other nations. For instance, if the descendants of Japheth are what we would think of as the Europeans and those who have descended from the European peoples, those people don't play as big a role to the descendants of Abraham as do a lot of other people. But would that be a fair statement? In today's world. And we have, let me put it this way. Our president's over in the Middle East right now visiting Israel. Those are the, for the most part, those are the direct natural descendants of Abraham. What outside nations most affect those people on a daily basis?
Iran, of course.
Abraham.
Okay, you got the Arabs, you've got the people directly to their west, which are the Palestinians. So you have those nations which surround them, the Egyptians, Palestinians, the Iranians, they're trying to affect them greatly. The Jordanians, the Syrians, all those nations which are directly surround them. So even though we're well aware of them, we're acquainted with them, I mean, we're supposedly their ally, on a daily basis we don't have nearly as much effect on their everyday life as other nations do, as other people do. So that's always been the way it is. And still today is same way. Now you have a second brother that got off the boat. His name Ham. Now you can trace the descendancy of Ham. Of course, Ham's son, one of Ham's sons was cursed, that being Canaan. You know, what did we decide last week was the cursing of Ham's son Canaan? Well, Noah judged Ham of poor character, I guess is what we would say, and because of that, he said, "Cursed be Canaan." Well, that's nothing worse than you can walk through a Walmart a lot of times, and you can see parents with their kids there, and you can tell that these are not good parents. They're rather poor parents a lot of times. And so you say, well, cursed be their kids. Why would their kids be cursed? Well, because they are growing up in such a poor parental environment that you know that the kids have little to no chance in life. They're going to grow up just like their parents or even worse. And chances are they're going to be ne'er-do-wells just like their parents are, or amount to even less than that. So that's exactly what Noah was saying about Canaan, Ham's son. Ham was of a poor character, and so Canaan, which was Ham's first son, Noah said he's not going to amount to much of anything. So we come to Genesis chapter, so many people want to make it about race, and that's just the wrong thing to do. And you'll see why. Because from Ham came a lot of various peoples throughout the earth, and great civilizations. Many of the great cities of antiquity were built, and many of the great empires came from the descendants of Ham. To say that all of Ham's descendants were cursed, or all of, they were all a bunch of lazy, type of people, or this, that, or the other thing, is just a wrong assumption. And so you take a look and see what the descendants of Ham, who the descendants of Ham were, and it's easy to draw the conclusion that Ham's descendants were, in fact, great people in a lot of cases. The sons of Ham, verse 6, Cush and Mizraim. Some of these names are going to catch me. Phut, I think is how you say that, and Canaan. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sata, Ramath, and Sabteca, the sons of Rama, Sheba, and Dedan, and Cush begat Nimrod. Now we're going to deal with Nimrod in chapter 11 again. And he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before the Lord. If you turn to, I believe, First Chronicles chapter 1 in your Bible. I think it's where we find it. Yeah. In First Chronicles, that's exactly where we find it. First Chronicles, I just want to point this out to you. The Chronicles starts out also with a genealogy. And it starts with Adam, by the way. But if you look at verse 10, it says, Cush begat Nimrod, he began to be mighty upon the earth. It leaves out the hunter part and just tells you that he began to be mighty upon the earth. So it gives you a better insight as to the position that Nimrod was taking. He began to be a mighty leader, a leader of people on the earth. He was making something of himself amongst people. It's not that he was just a great hunter or anything like that, but he was also a great man amongst men, and he began to be a great leader of people. So, First Chronicles, you can also go to as a genealogy, and that too will add a lot of times definition to what you read here in Genesis. And the beginning of his kingdom, back in Genesis chapter 10, verse 10. See, Nimrod made, because he was a great man, because he was a leader of people, he became a king. Or he made himself king. I don't know which the case was. But the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom was Babel. And Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Now, I don't have a blackboard down here. There's a lot of discussion about, and has been for years and years, about where the land of Shinar would be in relation to where the ark landed. The ark, the Bible testifies that the ark landed on Mount Arafat. Arafat is the dead Palestinian leader. Mount Ararat, that in Turkey. Now that would be the far east end of Turkey, just above Syria, where Syria and Iran, Iran and Turkey and Syria almost come together there in the mountains. And so geographically, we know where Mount Ararat is. Now, the land of Shinar is land between the rivers. And what we're going to find out is that Babel was built on a plain, which, of course, a plain would be a level area without mountains. Many scholars, you know, the search for Babel and has, you know, gone on for years and years and years, and many scholars have taken the opinion that Babel is the original site of Babylon, and they're one and the same. That, unfortunately, is impossible, because we know where the ancient city of Babylon is located, probably about 50 miles southeast of Baghdad, you know, the city that we took from Saddam Hussein. And that would be quite a bit south of Mount Ararat. Shinar is quite an extensive area. And in Daniel chapter, is it Daniel chapter 1, I believe? It is. If you look at Daniel chapter 1, you see in the third year of his reign in Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. So we know that Babylon is located in the land of Shinar. And from that, of course, many people make the assumption that Babel also is located in land of Shinar, but the other cities, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, that were part of the kingdom of Nimrod, they are not in the same geographical area as Babylon. So without going into terrific detail and having charts and graphs and everything, what it comes down to is Babel is not the same as Babylon. The Tower of Babel, the city of Babel, is probably quite a bit north and up near the border of Syria and Turkey, just a little west of Mount Ararat. So it's in the same geographical area as Mount Ararat, but just a little west, quite a bit north of Babylon. So meanwhile, and out of that land, verse 11, went forth Asher and builded Nineveh. Now Nineveh is, of course, quite a bit north of Babylon also, and you have to go east from Babel, from the area where I'm telling you that Babel is, to get to Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth and Calneh, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calneh, the same as a great city, and Mizraim. So you see the cities that were built by the descendants of Ham. These were all great cities. Matter of fact, Nineveh, of course, was the one that Jonah preached to, and they all repented. And Nineveh was originally scheduled to be destroyed by God, and because they repented, God didn't destroy it until he eventually did. But meanwhile, and Mizraim begat Ludim and Anannim and Lehabim and I'm glad people aren't naming these things anymore. Naphtuhim and Pathrusim and Kazlehim, out of who came Philistim. Now, of course, Philistim, there is where you get the Philistines, and Kathroim. Now, verse 15, you have specifically Canaan and his descendancy. Canaan, of course, is the one who is cursed by Noah. He is the son of Ham. And from Canaan came a lot of different nations, and they are generally known as Canaanites. Generally known as Canaanites. So here's some names that are going to be familiar to you, I suspect. Verse 15 through 19, Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, the Hamathite, and afterward were the families of the Canaanite spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest the Gerar unto Gaza. Gaza is still a contested area, is it not? With the Palestinians, as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. Now, if you look at Deuteronomy chapter 20, here's the issue with those of the Canaanites. The Canaanites were real people. The Canaanites were real people. And I did some research on the Canaanites. And, you know, they've done a lot of archaeological work and dug up a lot of things. And one of the articles that I found about the Canaanites says that the comparison of the cult objects and mythological texts of the Canaanites with those of the Egyptians and Mesopotamian forces one conclusion that Canaanite religion was much more completely centered on sex and its manifestations. In no country has so relatively great a number of figurines of the naked goddess of fertility, some distinctly obscene, been found. Nowhere does the cult of serpents appear so strongly. the two goddesses, one being Astarte, and Anath, are called the great goddesses which conceive but do not bear. And so, in addition to explaining the reason for the extermination of the Canaanites, this helps to identify who the Canaanites are. And when we look at Deuteronomy chapter 20, you see the reason for the different treatment of the Canaanites from that of all other people. Muslims will try to attack God as a bloody God and a God, a bloodthirsty God, and that is not the case at all. You need to realize exactly what the case is when those of Israel were crossing the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. And especially non-believers, those who are atheists, they will also accuse Christians of having a bloodthirsty God because they know about the Old Testament. So what was really going on? Look in Deuteronomy chapter 20, starting in verse 10, and look and see what God's instructions are. It says, "When thou comest nigh to a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. And it shall be, if it make thee answer of peace, and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be tributaries unto thee, and they shall serve thee." So, if you come to a city and you say, all we want is peace, and they agree to that, then there's not going to be a bloodshed. "And if it will make no peace with thee, but will make war against thee, then thou shalt besiege it. And when the Lord thy God hath delivered it into thine hands, thou shalt smite every male thereof with the edge of the sword. But the woman and the little ones and the cattle, all that is in the city, even all the spoil thereof, shalt thou take unto thyself. And thou shalt eat the spoil of thine enemies, even which the Lord thy God hath given thee. Thus shalt thou do to all the cities which are far off from thee, which are not of the cities of these nations." Which nations are those, God? "But of the cities of these people, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth." So in other words, the instructions we just read do not apply to these people that God's about to name. Because God has different instructions for these people. He says, "Thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Pezerites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord God hath commanded thee." Notice who they are. Those are all the descendants of Canaan. Those are the ones who have been found through archaeological evidence to be just depraved in their worship of false goddesses and gods. Just utterly depraved. And these are the ones who were besides everything else, sacrificing their children in the fire to Moloch. And so God says, when you come across these people, I've got special instructions for you. "You utterly destroy them all, that they teach you not to do after their abominations, which they have done unto their gods. So you should sin against the Lord your God. And when thou shalt besiege a city a long time in making war against it to take it, thou shalt not destroy the trees thereof by forcing an axe against them, for thou mayest eat of them, so on and so forth. But meanwhile, when they go against those particular people, they're to kill everybody without discretion. Man, woman, children, everybody. Anybody else they come across, if they can make peace, that's fine. If they want to go to war, just kill the men and spare the women and children. But these particular people, it was a whole different story, because they were completely over the top with the depravity. And that is where those were the particular descendants of Canaan. Not the descendants of Ham, all the descendants of Ham, but the descendants of the one son, which was Canaan.
Sometimes God demands that they kill the livestock too, all the animals. I was reading once in a book about that, well, it mentioned that, and this author believed that the reason for that was the people were so wicked they practiced bestiality, and perhaps he thought they had infected, the animals were infected with disease, venereal disease, people, between animals and people, the disease was being spread. That was his thought.
It's very possible. It is very possible. The things that they were doing is just apparently were just beyond the pale. So God said, destroy it all and don't even look back. Of course, the fact of the matter is they didn't do as God commanded, and they did not destroy the Canaanites, and sometimes even intermarried with them. So that's neither here nor there anymore. But meanwhile, they were to be completely destroyed and weren't. But the sons of Ham are generally the ones that are the ones that are vexing the descendants of Abraham today. They're the ones that are surrounding and vexing them with, you know, on a daily basis. They're the ones shooting the rockets into Jerusalem, you know, just yesterday. So it's the sons of Ham that are causing the problems. The next group is the sons of Shem. Well, verse 20, these are the sons of Ham after their families, tongues, their countries, and their nations. From Shem come the Shemite people, and from them the Lord is descended. So you have direct descendancy from Shem to the Lord. You can trace the ancestry that way. And generally the descendants of Shem, because we know pretty much who they are, they're descended in a particular region from Asia Minor to the northern Tigris region, Persian Gulf region to northern India, and of course a lot different areas now. They're throughout the world, but at the time that's where they were. And Genesis chapter 10 verse 21 says, unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth the elder, even to him were children born. The children of Shem, Elam and Asher and Arphaxad. Now, of course, Arphaxad, he is going to be the, I believe, the great-great-granddaddy, maybe the great-great-great-granddaddy of Abraham. And Lud and Aram and the children of Aram are Uz. Abraham comes from the land of Uz. And Hul and Gether and Mash. And Arphaxad began Salah. Salah is this is the line of Abraham here, and Salah begat Eber. Now you have a dispersion of people. We're going to talk about the dispersion of the people in Genesis chapter 11 here. The dispersion of people takes place during the life of Peleg. And unto Eber, verse 25, were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. The word Peleg means division. And his brother's name was Joktan. The continents in this world were formed during the time of the flood. Continents were formed during the time of the flood. And of course, there is good geological evidence that there was an ice age, or that there were ice sheets that covered a good part of the earth at one time. I don't know that this is any big news, but during the 16th and 17th centuries, 17th and 18th centuries, there was what was called the mini ice age. That was only 200-300 years ago. There was a mini ice age where the northern hemisphere was quite a bit cooler than it is right now. Seems today we might be headed back into that, as it might. But you know, during the time of the Revolutionary War and before that, the climate was quite a bit cooler than it is right now. There was probably quite a bit of the world covered with ice at particular times, and probably forcing people to move, probably forcing people to move about, and we'll see that in chapter 11. You know, one of the, if you look at the United States, you go north through Ohio, for instance, just flat as a pancake. Just flat as a pancake. And you know, you go toward Michigan, it's just flat as a pancake for the most part. And then all of a sudden, as you go south, you get hills. Of course, the explanation for that is what? A glacier. The glacier came south, big ice sheet came south and pretty much flattened everything out. And there's good good evidence for that. A lot of the rocks and topsoil got deposited down this way. When we dug a well at my property 13 years ago at 150 some feet, seashells were coming up. So, who knows how they got there, but whether it was during the flood or whether it was glacier pushed them or where they came from, but there's been movement on the earth of different things. So. But we'll see that God caused people to move. Ice would make people move from north to south. And if Babel was at the northern end of what we consider Europe, up toward the very top of near the Turkey, where Turkey is today, at the very north end of Syria, in order to get them to move out and get going, ice would have done it. So, meanwhile, you have Peleg, and during his days was the earth divided, and people started moving around and heading out and staking out their own claim. You have modern Saudi Arabia being the general area for Shem's people. Joktan begat Almadad and Shelef and Hazar Mahab, Mabeth, I guess is what that is, and Jara, just a whole slew of people there. But meanwhile, all their dwelling was from Mesha as thou goest unto Shefar, a mount of the east. If you take a look at where the map is, from Mesha to Shefar, that is in the in Saudi Arabia. Both of those are in Saudi Arabia. So those areas of Shem are the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And these are the sons of Shem after their families, after their tongues, in the lands after their nations. Those are the originations of the people that were from where the Lord descended from. And these are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations in their nations. And by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Of course, all coming off the boat, they all spoke the same language. That just makes sense, doesn't it? And everybody speaking the same language is a problem. Everybody speaking the same language is a problem. When you have people who can communicate, they're going to get in trouble because they can all talk to one another. So as you start chapter 11, the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And then, as I mentioned before, from Mount Ararat, according to the King James Bible, and that's the Bible I'm going to believe, it came to pass, verse 2, as they journeyed from the east. Now, that would indicate they moved west. As you read other versions of the Bible, you can get all kinds of different things, and there's some Bibles that just eliminate the direction altogether because they're non-committal as to what direction they were moving. And that has to do with the location of Babylon, because Babylon, from Mount Ararat, is basically south. It would be southeast. So, you know, from the east would not get you to Babylon at all. So you're moving to Babel, which is a different location than Babylon. And so it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. So, like I say, if you go home and you find a map, look at the far, far very edge of Turkey, you'll find Mount Ararat. As you go east and just a little south, you'll find where Iraq and Syria come together, and that is approximately where Babel is was located at the time. You get out of the mountains and you find a plain. The Lord's direction to Noah was to repopulate the earth, to spread out, to move out throughout the earth, and people being who they are, they're going to disobey the Lord at every turn. And that's exactly what's going on here. It's nothing but disobedience against whatever the Lord has to say. So it came to pass that they found the plain in the land of Shinar. They dwelt there. They decided to band together and disobey God's will. Genesis 11, 3 and 4. And they said one to another, "Go, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone, and slime they had for mortar. So if they're going to make brick, what are they doing? They're building permanent structures. I can't think of any type of structure that's more permanent than a brick structure. You can have a tent which is mobile, you can have wood which is going to rot away, but a brick structure is a permanent structure. You put it there, you mortar it together, and it's there. So that's exactly what they had planned. They were going to stay there, they weren't moving out. And they said, "Go to, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven." What would be the purpose of building a tower with a top that would reach unto heaven?
Be with God.
It would need God.
It's a multi-purpose tower. First of all, if they have a tower that can reach unto heaven, they can do just as Satan would like to do in Isaiah chapter 14. He's the one who wants to ascend into the heights and be as God. And so, remember in the garden where the serpent comes up to Eve and says, you can be as gods. All you have to do is take a bite of this fruit and your eyes will be open to the truth. And you can be as gods. And Satan's plan all along was to get the worship of others and to be as God. And in Isaiah 14 it says he wants to ascend to the heights of heaven. Well, in order to be as God, you have to ascend into heaven. And so they want a tower that's going to ascend them into heaven. The other thing is that if they have a tower that ascends into heaven, that's where they're going to be safe from God flooding them out again. Even though God has made a promise, that's not what he's going to do. Better safe than sorry. Let's take our security into our own hands and never more be at the mercy of God. So if we have a tower, we can save ourselves. No longer do we need God to save us. So
should be a stranger with a big ball and one stick coming out of it.
Yeah, a big ball with one stick coming out of it. Yeah. Well, and let us make us a name. So that's exactly what it's all about. It's them being their own God and taking control of their own fate and destiny, rather than placing their dependency upon God. It's they are going to be their own God, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. So they weren't about to be scattered like God had commanded that they do. They were going to stay in one place. We're all going to stick together. We're not going to do what God's plan is. We're going to fight against that. We've got a better plan. We've got a much better plan. I mean, knowing that, looking back on at what their plan was as compared to what God's plan is, look around the world at the gigantic cities that we built. A Mexico City, which I'm not sure if that's the largest city in the world or not, but it has
it used to be.
It used to be.
It still is, but it used to be.
Yeah. You have Mexico City, you have Los Angeles, which is one of the largest in the world. What's the one in South America?
Rio de Janeiro.
Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
There's another one. Buenos Aires, is that?
Argentina.
In Argentina, you'd have cities like New York City, just incredibly large cities where people have decided we're going to stick together. And out of those, what good comes out of any of those?
Trouble.
Yeah, anywhere that you have that conglomeration of people, it's always trouble.
Crime is always high.
Crime is always high. Poverty is always high. Trouble is always high. People are always fighting and there's always murder and there's always theft and there's always trouble. You know, just trouble of every sort.
That's because a sane man don't want to go there.
Well, it always happens in the city. You get people spread away from each other as God had intended, and the problems subside.
I think your quality of life diminishes too.
Well, certainly your quality of life diminishes because of all the problems that it brings.
Well, even if you aren't a victim to any of those problems, you're dependent on too many people in the city for your food, for everything.
Well, that's what the city is all about. You, a city by definition almost, you become and make yourself dependent upon other people rather than being dependent upon God and His plan. It's man being dependent upon man. Because there's no way to to provide for yourself in a city. You're at the mercy of the system, mm-hmm. of the man-made system when you're in a city.
And the Bible says that we're selfish people by nature, and we love darkness, so when you crowd us together around each other, no good thing is going to come out of that.
That's right. That's right. Well, and as long as any man can make another man subservient to them, they're going to do that. And the easiest way to do that is to get them to move to an area that they're just naturally going to become enslaved or become entrapped into that subservient lifestyle without knowing it. And suddenly they're there, and I mean, you know, people, years ago, people moved from the country into the city willingly, thinking there's opportunity in the city.
Right.
And then once they got here, they could never move out because they became dependent upon other people for their livelihood and everything else that they had.
Yeah, I remember looking at my grandfather and grandmother in Louisiana. They did everything for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, people like them were like the original entrepreneurs in this country. But like you said, when the factories started up, it pulled them off the farms mm-hmm. and into the cities. And then those farms, if you let them go for so long, you can't go back and start them back up.
People move from the Appalachians, from Kentucky, from Tennessee, all over those areas to here, to Dayton, Ohio, because of what they perceived as opportunity with factories and with GM and with tool shops. And once they got here, they're trapped because they can't go back. And now, where's the opportunity? And so you have an entire population of people. They're here. They're stuck. And now they are completely dependent upon the system. Now they're completely dependent upon the government.
Yeah, the Kroger stores was closed. They couldn't, if you passed out seeds, they couldn't even stick them in the ground.
No.
No. They'd die off.
No. And that's exactly what you're looking at here. That's exactly what you're looking at. Let's build us a city. You know, it's so much better than living out there by yourself. It's going to be safe here with other people. And that's the attraction. It's so much safer when we're in a group. Come live with us because you'll be safe. You won't be out there by yourself. And think of the benefits. You know, if you get sick, we'll help you. If you get hurt, you have a hospital. You know, and all these benefits. Why there's going to be lights and there'll be roads and all. You know, if it snows, we'll all pitch in and all these problems will be solved. The problem is that you lose the self-sufficiency and you lose what God has given you, and that is the ability to do. And not, then God isn't your God, other men become your God. And that's exactly what has happened here. And so the Lord knows the end result of that. And so Genesis chapter 11, verse 5. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, the people is one. Notice that. The people is one. They didn't say the people are one, like it's many people. He said the people is one. There is, it's as a singular. Almost, has anybody seen, has anybody here a fan of Star Trek?
Yeah.
You ever seen the movie where they fight the Borg?
Yeah.
And it's just this giant cube. That goes through space, and they see it coming, and once they knew what it was, it's the Borg. And what it is, it's these all these thousands and millions of what they look like, men with all these cubes sticking out of them, and they're individuals, except they're not. They're all controlled by one. You know, they're just controlled by one central control. So it's they is one. I mean, all these millions, they're one. And that's what happens. That's what happens. I mean, didn't you hear the president in his inauguration speech? We all have to act as one. We can't be individuals anymore. We can't be going and doing our own thing. We can't act as, you know, we can't think as individuals and take individual initiative. We have to act as a collective.
Try to bring in the kingdom without the king, huh?
Yeah, try to bring in the kingdom without the king.
Well, there is certainly something to be said for unity, but you cannot sacrifice.
Having unity of purpose is one thing. That's right, but you cannot give away individuality,
right.
and that for the.
Absolutely.
That's right, and that's what goes on, especially in a city type environment, especially when you have this. So the Lord said, "Behold, the people is one, and they all have one language." And they're all doing the same thing. And they're all working the same goal. And that goal isn't a good goal. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. What in the world does that mean? Well, I just know from experience, I can imagine all kinds of things. And the Bible tells me all about the imagination. Genesis 8:21 says, "The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." Proverbs 6:18 says, "A heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief." Jeremiah 13:10 says, "This evil people which refuse to hear my words, which walk in the imagination of their heart, and walk after other gods to serve them and to worship them, shall even be as this girl, which is good for nothing." People imagine all kinds of things. And most of the things that they imagine are not good things. Most of them are evil. And you get a collective of people together, and what you have is a collective of evil imaginations going on.
And Paul said, casting
down imaginations. That's right. That's right. And, you know, That's right now the fear in Europe. I mean, does anybody know what's going on in Cyprus? Where the European Union, Cyprus is in debt, and the European Union says, we're going to take so much of everybody's money out of the bank.
They didn't like that.
Well, But somebody, you know, there's a group of people sat around a table and said, what can we do? And we imagined we could do that. But even worse than that, after they said that, then there's people all over the world around tables saying, I wonder if that would work here too. You see, evil imaginations get started everywhere. Yeah. Say, well, you know, we'll let them try that. If it works good, maybe we'll try that too.
Yeah.
You see, evil imaginations. It's infectious. It's infectious with men. So, but if no one could understand what the next person was saying, they would be imagining evil, but they couldn't communicate it. And so God confused their language. So even though they were imagining evil, they couldn't tell the next one what their imagination was. So God looks and says, go to, let us go down. And there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech.
There weren't enough collectively in each language group to finish the project themselves.
That's correct.
There's none.
It takes cooperation.
Yeah.
It takes cooperation. So they had to scrap their plans, and as you see in the very next verse, of course, having different languages, it was enough. But you see that the Lord scattered them abroad. So we know that there was an ice age. Well, they being far enough north, it wouldn't surprise me. The verse doesn't specifically say how the Lord scattered them, but the Lord pushed them out of there. Yeah.
You know, we see a big strong rock, and you know what can happen? A little crack gets in there, and some water gets in there, ice can split that rock.
That's right.
And that's probably split these three continents. Just with that glacier, probably.
Well, so the Lord scattered them abroad. The Lord pushed them and made them move and got them out of there. From thence upon the face of all the earth. And so he spread them out. He says, you're not staying here in one place. You're moving. And they did. And they left off to build the city. So they quit building the city of Babel. Wherefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did therefore confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth.